Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Doug Mead, who's an expert on combination products, and he's the founder of Combination Product Pathways. On this episode, Doug walks through drug master files and device master files, explaining their purpose, the different types, and what differences there are between them. Doug gives examples from his experience in the industry and discusses the advantages and challenges of using the different master files for combination product regulatory submissions. Please give the show 5 stars right now on whatever platform you're listening on, and please share this episode with one friend. And with that, I hope you enjoy this episode with Doug. Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating. What need is a drug master file or device master file fulfilling? What is it satisfying?
Let me give a quick overview of drug master files and then device master files so everyone's oriented. So a drug master file is a formal submission to CDER or CBER, and it's broken down into 5 types. The first type is type 1 for manufacturing and facility information. Type 2 is for drug product and drug substance information, and it can go into excipients, starting materials, manufacturing processes, things like that. Type 1s and 2s are typically filed by the drug company because they want to reference the additional detail and not have that be part, say, of their NDA or BLA. And then we go on to a type 3, which is for packaging information. And there's a long list. It can include polymer plastics, it can include elastomers, the materials themselves. And then at a higher level, it can be packaging materials like shrink wrap tubing, or it can be even Tyvek tubing or Tyvek sheets. And then we get into more sophisticated packaging. Typically for primary containers, it can be syringe barrels, cartridges. It can be even a pen injector or even auto injector component parts that form the final product when assembled. And so it's very broad in terms of type 3. Type 4 is for typically tox information. I don't get involved in that at all. And type 5 is for anything else, although I haven't really seen or heard of it used very much. It's kind of like you have to ask FDA if a type 5 would be appropriate, and then they allow you to submit it. In contrast, we have on the device side, MAFs or master access files or device master files, and these are submitted to CDRH. They can be submitted by a pharma company if they have a platform they want to frequently reference certain details, or they can be submitted by a supplier of a delivery device, for example. So historically, there have been many master files submitted. It's a less formal process than DMFs. DMFs have to be submitted following a certain template, and they have to be reviewed, or they are reviewed by FDA for content completeness, and you have to submit an annual report to them. MAFs are much less onerous in terms of maintaining them. You can submit them. You only have to update them when there's a change to that content, and they're only reviewed with respect to a drug or device submission that requests that review of that master file. So that's a quick overview of what they are.
Do you remember the first one that you worked on?
Yes, I do. It's an interesting case because it goes way back. I was working for a pharmaceutical company. They had a patch pump called the MediPad, and they wanted to work with various pharma partners.
What is a patch pump? Sorry.
It's like an on-body injector or infuser. It delivered 3 to 5 mLs over 24 to 48 hours, depending on how it was set up internally. And it adhered to the body with subcutaneous infusion for the whole time. So it was way ahead of its time. This, again, was in 2001. Way ahead of its time, and it didn't make it to market. But I called up FDA and said, we think we'd like to submit a master file. So they gave me a lot of guidance on what to do. And I basically submitted one that was very much like a 510K, which I'd been working on for years. The description of the product, how it functioned, the design verification testing, process validation in terms of how it's made, a little bit of human factors information. But again, it was more like a 510K that could be referenced by a pharma partner for their INDs. That was my first one. And then working for another pharma company, our first auto injector, we thought would be a platform. So this was 2007. So again, I took the approach where this is going to be reviewed by CDRH. It should be similar in content to a 510K, but with some manufacturing risk information and some human factors information. So we submitted that in 2007, and we used it for one BLA and multiple INDs as a platform technology. So that was originated by the pharma company, so there was no actual supplier involvement. I think and then subsequently I've worked for clients that have MAFs or device master files from their suppliers that are then incorporated by reference and a letter of authorization by the pharma company. So here's where I started to see a few things going off. In our case for the 2007 MAF and looking at other delivery devices within that company, we started to question, well, if we have a supplement for a design change to a delivery device that is described in a master file, we have to update the master file and we have to prepare that same content for a prior approval supplement or CBE-30. So it was redundant information. So the question was, why don't we just put the MAF content directly into the submission and abandon the MAF? And ultimately, that decision was made. And from that point on, we no longer use master files. I think the other problem that comes up when you have a supplier...
Is that because on the device side, it's not as important to maintain the MAF as it is with the DMF?
It's distinctly different in the sense that the MAF is just a device content. If you can put that information into, say, module 3, typically 3.2R medical devices, it's going to be almost identical to what the MAF would contain. Because FDA doesn't expect you to do deep dives on injection molded components. They really want to know that you're assembling the components that are to spec and you've done process validation on that. You've done design verification of your to-be marketed product using a qualified manufacturing process. And that all has to be in the NDA or BLA anyway. So it would be redundant to have that in a master file that you have to update in the life cycle at the same time you do a supplement to it. So for future delivery devices, we said, let's just put it all into a 3.2R section. And that's ultimately what we did. I think for other pharma companies that rely on a supplier master file, and I think the main problem is the pharma company has no idea what's in a supplier MAF. So they don't know whether the content is there that FDA would expect. They don't know the quality of the wording. They don't know what exactly is said at all. So in the review process, say at FDA, the master file holder will get questions. The pharma company is informed that questions are out there for the supplier, but it's not clear what those questions are or how they're being addressed by the supplier. So there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not you're going to get your NDA, BLA approved if there's a major deficiency with the supplier's MAF. And I think the other problem, and I've seen this in correspondence from pharma companies, is the FDA will tell the pharma companies, we're unable to find the information in the master file. Please respond to these following questions. And they are very fundamental questions that should have been in the MAF, should have been easily located, but were not. So the pharma company ultimately has to track down that information from the supplier and prepare a response to an information request with that information. So that can be a tricky thing in the middle of an FDA review. So again, I think there is a role for device master files, and it would be for platform auto-injectors or pen injectors where, you know, you truly have a information that you would want to leave in a master file, not put into an NDA, BLA, but would be referenced. And a typical example might be biocompatibility information of, say, patient contact materials. As long as you don't change those materials, they're going to be the same material used in every NDA or BLA going forward. And you could simply reference that information in your NDA and BLA and say, all the biocompatibility information, the biocompatibility reports, the samples used for testing, the elutions, are all in the master file. That's one useful approach to a device master file, I think. When it comes to other things, I think it's more discretionary whether or not it should be in an NDA or BLA. One of the overlaps between DMFs and MAFs is suppliers can put like a prefilled syringe barrel information or even a pen injector component information into a DMF. The problem is that CDER and CDRH don't necessarily have access to the master files held by those centers. So if CDRH wants to know what's in a DMF, they have to contact CDER and get access.
Is that right?
Yeah. That is a problem. And likewise, if there's information that CDER wants to know and it happens to be in an MAF, it's problematic for CDRH to supply that information to, say, a chemistry reviewer or a clinical reviewer at CDER.
And outside of the jurisdiction and one being for device and drug, is there any reason that or anything that's so distinctive between one and the other that from your perspective would require for them to be two different things?
I don't think so. As we get into type 3 DMFs, they start to look very much like what would be in a device master file. And some of them, I just skimmed them the other day. There's a few auto injector DMFs. There's a few pen injector DMFs. There's multiple syringe DMFs, including fully functional syringes. There's cartridges that are primary containers, obviously. But it starts to become like, why was a DMF chosen as the master file type for this information when an MAF could have been used? And I think it's if a supplier, even a pharma company, is familiar with DMFs, then they tend to want to submit a DMF for something that is more like a device. On the other hand, since there's no structure or expectation for MAFs, an MAF applicant is unsure exactly what constitutes substantial device information. And you can go into quite a bit of levels of detail about whether or not you need to disclose injection molding processes or your component suppliers or what they look like, or testing of components, which is typically a level that's not necessarily addressed in an NDA or BLA.
So muscle memory plays into it in some ways.
I think, yeah. The precedent that a company has followed, they're familiar with the DMF process and they tend to use that. And suppliers are more familiar with DMFs than MAFs. And it's because there isn't a lot of guidance on MAFs. If you read the latest guidance on it, they don't really provide a lot of detail on what content would be appropriate for an MAF.
There's no CTD format, put this here and that there and so on.
No. And it's problematic because it doesn't follow an ECTD structure. Say you submit a major MAF and then you want to do a design modification of, say, your auto injector. It can be just a description of that design modification and how you did a bridging in terms of design verification of that single design change. How do you do that? You layer an amendment or multiple amendments on your original submission, and then the CDRH reviewer is wondering, do I have to start from square one and review everything or just the amendment? How do I get a full picture? And the solution industry has found for those who write MAFs is to essentially rewrite the whole MAF again with a design modification. So if you have multiple major submissions, if you want to make it reviewer friendly to a CDRH reviewer.
Are DMFs, MAFs required?
No. I'm unsure of this because I deal more on the device side.
Yep.
Whether or not you could submit an NDA without a type 1 and a type 2 DMF, I think FDA would expect that information to be submitted in a DMF. In contrast, DMFs are only available as a mechanism in the U.S. and I believe Canada for rest of world, particularly EMA applications, that you would have to find a way to get that same DMF information into your MAA, for example. Mm. They're useful in the U.S. submission to a limited degree. They're expected, but I can't say whether or not they're required.
The normal steady state push-pull of industry, there's flexibility that's afforded in terms of the regulatory strategy that one chooses to partake in. And effectively, to the point that you were making earlier, to the point that you just made on the MAFs being rewritten for reviewer friendliness, the point that you made even before that on the, you know, so long as if the information's in the NDA, then why do I need to put it into an MAF and just have it be like this thing that was supposed to be convenient that is now just this thorn in my side, right? And from your perspective, are there any situations where you're like, absolutely the best way to do it is to use a DMF?
I'm going to reference a sterile ready-to-fill syringe barrel from a supplier, and they provided you with a DMF, you ought to use that as a primary container DMF. When it comes to products that are either near-finished or assembled for finish, I think you're better off with a different content strategy for an NDA or BLA. And I've been advocating this now for several years, and industry is going in this direction, but The basic approach that I advocate is to develop a 3-2-R medical device section intended for the CDRH reviewer and any CDER reviewer that wants to review it. But it would include an adequate description with figures and photographs of your delivery system, a functional description of how it works, why it works the way it does, so that the CDRH reviewer has a deep understanding of what the product is and how it functions. Then you go into, the latest twist is you have to provide an overview of how you've complied with the ISO standards, application validation, stability, shipping verification, and even lot release, even though that's not design verification. And then I go into individual essential performance test sort of descriptions where I provide the purpose of the test, the acceptance criteria justification for the sample size justification, an overview of the test method, the results tables, and then a summary or conclusions of that individual test, why it should be acceptable to FDA. And then you support that with your source document in the appendix, which is the detailed testing that was done. And then I go on to process validation, manufacturing information, risk information, and I usually follow FDA's frequently communicated guidance to put human factors reports in Module 5, but I do include a significant summary section in a 3-2-R module because that is essentially design validation for your delivery system. And then the question is, if you do that, what do you need to put in the rest of Module 3? And so whether it's 3-2-P24, which is container closure, suitability, or the manufacturing section, or the specification section, or the second container closure section, the stability section, I would provide an overview of the content that's in 3-2-R so that if typically the CDER reviewer wants to review that, they see the summary, know it was done, and they can actually go to 3-2-R and read more about it in that kind of a structure. And I think the key is to provide what's called a roadmap or reviewer's guidance, talks about where in each of the modules 1 through 5, there's device content. It helps the CDRH reviewer and the CDER reviewer know where everything is related to the device. Now, that said, that is my approach and my strategy, but companies are free to use other structures like the P24 container closure section is intended to provide suitability information, which is very broad. It can include everything that would be most of 3-2-R in that section if a company chooses to do that. The P7 container closure section is typically the registration information, the materials of construction, and high-level mechanical drawings. That's really all that needs to be in there. Companies can stick with the P24, P7 approach, which I think is more difficult for a CDRH reviewer, rather than having a complete story told in a 3-2-R section.
I've seen some of, I know regulatory groups are structured in different ways at different companies, but I've worked at companies before that have a specific regulatory publishing function that are doing the work before the submission goes out, basically. And the wizardry, so to speak, of the referencing of everything and the hyperlinking, it's crazy. Can you talk a little bit more about the device roadmap? Because I haven't, I'm not a regulatory person, but I haven't heard of that conceptually before.
Basically an outline going through the modules, and say in module 1, you'd say device instruction for use. That would be its location because it's labeling under review. In module 2, it would be, say, the quality overall summary, which can be sort of a summary of 3-2-R, basically. It can even include a clinical overview where you use the device in a clinical trial and want to provide a couple paragraphs of its usability in that.
But it's essentially a device table of contents.
Exactly, yeah.
And it would go where?
In module one. And it's useful for the regulatory project manager because they're always wondering, I have to ship some stuff to CDRH. What modules do I ship to them? And if you look at the classic FDA approval review memo from CDRH, they will list the modules that they were assigned to review by the regulatory project manager at CDER. And they can always request more. In terms of hyperlinks, it is problematic. And one of the advantages of a 3-2-R section is you can hyperlink between sections of 3-2-R in that single module rather than across modules. But you're going to need a hyperlink for all the other module threes, like P24 container closure, provide the summary, and hyperlink it to 3-2-R, you know, things like that. And similarly for manufacturing, process validation, analytical methods, stability. I typically include limited redundant information, like in the stability section, where you'd want to show the stability information for the CDER reviewer as well as the CDRH reviewer for functional stability.
In that, you highlighted one situation where you effectively said, for sure, use a DMF in that case, and that's where you're purchasing a container or something like that that you're going to do something with, fill, then move forward into the rest of the value chain. That's right.
Yeah, and I think it's, again, a trend I'm starting to see, even with suppliers of, say, auto-injector components for assembly by the pharma company. They are discouraging all the use of master files for devices. They would provide under a CDA all the information that a pharma company needs. And then the pharma company has the benefit of knowing exactly what's in the submission.
And so that was going to be my next question is, how do you know that a DMF is good?
You don't. The content... If the pharma company writes it, they know the content. Otherwise, they don't. I think another problem I'm starting to see with not so much MAFs as when you want to get a letter of authorization to include a 510K, for example, in an IND. And these would be for finished devices, say a prefilled syringe. It can be for something like a syringe pump, where the owner of that 510K is reluctant to grant another FDA review of their product on behalf of an investigational new drug application or investigational drug application.
And so can you dive a little bit deeper into that? Is it that they're concerned that the reviewer would be finding something that they previously hadn't looked at, as in, I already have, let's say I'm company A, I already have my product approved, and company B has a very similar situation, and they say, you approved company A, therefore, surely company B should be approved. Company A says, yes, you approved me, however, I don't want you to review me again since I'm already approved.
Yeah, it can be a multitude of reasons. And having gone through this a few times now, you're never really clear why they're refusing to issue an LOA for a 510K product. Typical reasons are their 510K is 15 years old and it doesn't meet the current FDA expectations, say for biocompatibility, which has evolved. It can be that they're simply not interested in that market, or they don't want to incur any regulatory or product liability risk. So it's never really clear.
There's no upside for effectively somebody that's not, yeah. You find that net DMFs end up being a net positive, or are they a net inconvenience?
Again, I think it's dependent. If you're looking at something like a glass syringe barrel with a stake needle that is comes prepackaged, sterile, ready to fill in tubs, a DMF is a real convenient thing to just reference. You don't have to say anything more about sterility, things like that. So that is definitely convenience. Again, when you're starting to approach something that is a finished device or is intended to be assembled to create a finished device, it's more problematic. And for pharma companies doing platforms, I think the jury's still out on whether you can construct a master file that would be truly useful for cross-referencing in a number of drug applications and maintaining that MAF over the life cycle of the product as you're preparing supplements for individual drug approved drug NDA BLAs.
Where do you see master files going?
The trend is away from device master files that were the same content could be in a BLA NDA. And that speaks to the level of detail typically required for an NDA BLA, which is increasing, and yet information that is probably not needed for those approvals. Like you get into component level information, the FDA tends to assume that that is under control in your quality system, and that if you show that the assembled product functions and meets design requirements, that is sufficient for them.
In terms of working with suppliers, are there any suggestions you have in terms of greasing the wheel for working with suppliers that have a DMF? Is it something that you focus on during the introduction of a new supplier? Is it something that, like, where do DMFs
viewed MAF content? Typically, they're test protocols, test reports, method validation, things like that. So the difficulty is, as opposed to a 3-2-R structure where everything is in a single paragraph, you can't find an explanation for the sample size justification. Or you can't find an easily a test method because it's not in the test report. It's in the method section or method document. It's very difficult to see a comprehensive review of any particular test. So that was the number one thing. And then the structure of some of these reports, there's a lot of redundancy. They describe the product over and over again. I think the other aspect is some of these structures of the reports, they're written as a quality document or design controls. They don't explain things, why they did things, or what the results mean. It's like, here's the table of results, and that's the end of the document. There's that aspect. And in every case, there will be protocol deviations. They should be described at the end of the document and not at the beginning of the document, which I've seen before. So you don't want to start off on the wrong foot. And lastly, there are typically issues with data. So you have a great table except for one data point. You have to investigate that data point, determine whether it was a method issue, an operator issue, a faulty device. And in some cases, you have to have corrective action and evidence that corrective action was implemented and effective. So you need to have a discussion about that in the report. And I don't always see a comprehensive discussion in a lot of these MAF test reports.
In terms of the DMF itself, it actually includes all of the documents, or is it similar to the CTD where it's summaries?
No. Again, I'm talking more about MAFs. What I typically see is everything. So it's like a data dump. If you have a test report on an EPR, an essential performance requirement element, say for an auto injector, again, it's going to be the test protocol. It'll be ultimately a design verification test report. Now that would have a summary of the data. It would be statistical analysis of the data. And there would be an attachment to that report with the raw data, multiple pages of individual handwritten things like that. That level of detail is often provided in MAFs, where I don't think FDA is really reviewing that in great detail unless they want to do a deep dive themselves.
Final thoughts on master files?
No, I just think there's a few things. One is it would be nice if FDA had a single structure for master files where you didn't have to worry about whether CDRH can access them or CDER can access them. And they had software that spoke CDER and CDRH languages. The second aspect is to really question whether or not the level of detail you need for approval can be in a 3.2R section. And in my experience, it's more than adequate. And if the FDA has a particular question where you want they want more information, you can go back to a supplier and get that information. If you have an opportunity, I would review master file contents from your supplier if they're willing to share it with you. You have a confidentiality agreement. It shouldn't be a problem. It's not like a pharma company wants to develop an auto injector component, for example. They're just not in that business. Those would be three things. I think if you get a notice that there's a deficiency in a master file, you need to act on it quickly, like contact the supplier, get the details of what the question is, what they're doing about it, and what the timeline is for a response. Because a lot of these questions come in late in the cycle review, and you're left with uncertainty about whether or not this is going to be resolved. I think that covers it.
Where can people find you, Doug?
I have a website. I have an email, dmeadcppathways.com.
Coming on the show. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.